supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, even before Isaac Asimov wrote iRobot, the long-standing dream, well, and fear of humans has been to create an artificial life that possesses something philosophers have described as uniquely human. No field will likely have such an impact on the way we live our lives as that of artificial intelligence. Like it or not, there have been tremendous advances in robotics, smart robotics, over the last two decades since a computer beat a chess master in a tournament. Today, robots are assisting in surgery, helping autistic children, and even supplementing nursing care for the aging population. But should we be worried about making machines too human? And what about the ethical issues that go with that? Moreover, can a machine really do the very things that make us individuals? And if so, are we in danger of losing something essential about ourselves? Joining me now to discuss these and many more issues are Marvin Minsky and Kirsten Dautenhahn. Marvin Minsky is one of the pioneers of intelligence-based robotics. He's co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. He's a Toshiba professor of media arts and science, professor of electrical engineering and computer science there. He's also the author of Society and Mind, The Emotion Machine. Marvin Minsky, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dan. Nice to meet you.
And Kirsten Dautenhahn is a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. She's an associate editor of the International Journal of Social Robotics, and she is the founder of the Aurora Project, and we're going to hear much more about that later. Kirsten, welcome to the show.
Hello, Dan. Good to speak to you.
And our number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. We are talking about artificial intelligence. So, Marvin, I want to start with you, and I want to understand what it is and what it is not. I have a pacemaker in my chest. It monitors my heart, and when my heart goes below a certain level, it takes over. I hope it's got some intelligence, or else I'm in trouble. You helped create a computer that beat chess master Garry Kasparov. Are these examples of artificial intelligence, or no?
Well, that's a nice question, because those are two things at the opposite end of a... Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. At the opposite ends of a huge spectrum, the strange thing about this field of artificial intelligence is that it evolved sort of backwards, because in 1961, we developed a program that could... excuse me, my voice is not clear. This program developed by a young student named James Slagle was able to get a grade of A in a calculus course. And so here in 1961, everyone was very enthusiastic because it could do things that people considered to be very hard. On the other side, the kind of program in a pacemaker that recognizes various kinds of patterns and intervenes when it sees a bad one also come from that era. And I guess the amazing thing is that we were able to make them reliable over the years, so that chances are your gadget will keep working. But the interesting thing is that although machines were very good at what some people thought were very hard problems like calculus and chess, we still don't have machines that have the kind of common sense reasoning ability that a 3 or 4 year old child has. So it's, in a way, artificial intelligence is is evolving in a backwards way, and only today are we beginning to get even a little bit of common sense into computers
so
they can handle everyday situations.
Let me turn to Kirsten with that. And, you know, I want to pick out a few words Marvin just used. Common sense reasoning, is that what you're trying to replicate from human experience? Is any successful software program, does it have to understand what is intuitive for humans and its applications?
This notion of intuition is very important. It is something that I would, you know, absolutely agree, like many other people in AI, is still one of the main challenges. Now, what we can learn also from the evolution of primate intelligence, including human beings, is that what is very important for this type of behavior, this type of problem solving, is to deal with others. It's the so-called social intelligence, which is one of the driving forces of my own research, and is also very important in the Aurora project that you mentioned. So what we can learn from nature, meaning other social species, humans and also other primates and also non-human primates, is that some of the things that allow us to acquire this common sense knowledge have to do with growing up socially, growing up in a family, growing up in a society, and being able to deal with others, to negotiate, to make friends, to deal with you know, enemies, how to reconcile relationships if any problems have occurred. So these are all very very much concepts inspired by biology and psychology, which don't necessarily is what people associate with AI. But it has become very clear in the last 15-20 years in research that it is absolutely important to also consider these aspects of social in intelligence if we want to build truly artificially intelligent systems that interact in the real world, like interact with other people.
What you're describing, I'm trying to wrap my mind around teaching a machine to do that. It's inconceivable. I can't imagine that being done. Can you?
It is very, very hard, and not surprisingly, there are many, many, you know, worldwide, large-scale research projects. I myself involved here in Europe. We have a number of European projects that are looking at specific aspects of this social intelligence that I mentioned. For example, joint attention, you know, for example, predictive abilities, how to try to predict what another agent is doing, research into memory, how can you learn from interaction histories, how can you learn from building up relationships. These are all, I would absolutely agree, these are very, very hard problems, which makes it interesting for scientists because it gives us something to do certainly for the next few decades.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As a clinical psychologist, you know, we are going in a slightly different direction now. Excuse me. That, you know, you are working on memory and holding memory in these machines and using them. And as a clinician, one of the things we're working on is helping people let go of memories and not let memories drive their behavior. So
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, this is when I mentioned memory, I should probably clarify what I don't mean is a machine that is simply storing anything it is seeing, hearing, experiencing, but a machine that is trying to make sense of what's going on, and that also does involve forgetting. And as you say, there are certainly many, many things that are very useful to forget, and not only things that maybe personally have a, you know, deeper meaning and you should really get over them, but also from the point of view of efficiency, it is just not very useful,
right,
to build machines that are just blindly storing everything that they experience.
Marvin, let's go back in the other direction. Kirsten and I have been talking about the present and the future. Let's go back to history a little bit. In 51, you built SNARC, S-N-A-R-C. It was the first neural network learning machine. How did it learn, and what did you learn, Marvin?
Well, that excuse me, my voice is still not working right. That machine was based on an old idea of reinforcement, which is that the way an animal learns is by generating some behaviors and then trying them out, and then which certain of them get rewarded by food or whatever the animal's goal is, and those are reinforced. And in fact, when I was a young student, I worked for Fred Skinner at Harvard and helped wire the cages. And so a great deal of this research in the previous century was done on dogs and pigeons and rats because those animals were convenient, and quite a lot was learned. And one problem was that this theory of reinforcement by trial, error, and reward became very popular, and it sort of replaced all of the older theories in psychology. In the 1800s, we had three or four great psychologists, Francis Galton in England and Sigmund Freud in Austria, and William James here in the United States, and they made cognitive theories, and there the idea was that a person actually thinks and represents knowledge in different ways, and then when a problem comes up, you somehow remember an experience that's similar to it or analogous, and you do what seemed to work in the past. And we don't have that yet in our machines. So that my idea is that the wonderful thing about human thinking is that whenever we have a problem, we can look at it in many different ways, and we can represent a situation socially, or we can represent it as a logical problem, or we can represent it as a physical problem, or a economic problem, and so forth. And to me, the important thing is how can we get a machine to look at things in 5 or 10 different ways and select the one that's appropriate. And so I agree with Kirsten that in many situations you have to predict what another person will do and the things that you could do and how they'll react to that, and that involves maybe 100,000 little facts and fragments of knowledge that you've picked up in your early years about how people react to things.
You referred to Freud, and I know you've referred to him in your writings and previous interviews. When I think about it, Freud really looked at the mind in a pretty structural, dispassionate way. You know, he had the superego, the ego, the id, which controls our impulses. You called him one of the first computer scientists.
Well, in fact, he made... he wrote a paper about the first neural networks, and he had a little theory which was called a project for a scientific psychology, and it had various ideas about how connections between cells in the brains might work. And the strange thing is that he couldn't get it published. It wasn't published
right
until 1950. And so if Freud has a reputation of being preoccupied with sex and social matters, but in fact he had a, I would say that his idea of the mind was that it had many parts, and that's the direction I've pursued. I think of most psychologists as suffering from, this is a joke, from physics envy, because they're trying to find a few simple principles that would explain everything. But if you look at the brain, you see that there are hundreds of kinds of cells and all sorts of different networks, and different parts of the brain work in slightly different ways. And the reason people are so resourceful is that when one way of thinking doesn't work, you switch to another.
You know what? You're right. Some psychologists do suffer from physics envy and do try to reduce the mind to something mechanical and structural.
In fact, there's a nice... I was listening to an early interview you did about post-traumatic growth.
Growth, yes.
And one of the things about the human mind is we have a kind of not traumatic growth, but what happens when you solve a problem? Suppose it took you 10 or 20 minutes to solve a problem. Well, the current theories that are based on Skinner and Pavlov and reinforcement say, well, when you did the right thing, you remember that. And I think that's true of dogs and pigeons and rats. But the big difference that psychologists haven't zeroed into for humans is that if you spend 10 or 15 minutes solving a problem, then when you solve it, well, you don't learn much from having solved it, because that means that some part of your mind knew how to do it. But what you do then is say, why did I waste so much time? Why did it take me so long? Why was I so stupid about this? And so my theory is that in humans, the big thing is that we learn from our mistakes, and we learn, you might say, an expert is not somebody who knows exactly what to do, but an expert is somebody who knows the 5 or 10,000 most common mistakes, and that's where our competence comes from. So there's a sort of negative learning that psychologists haven't, negative expertise that psychologists haven't really emphasized yet.
Yeah, I agree with you completely about learning from our mistakes. I from personal experience, that's the only time I've really learned important lessons, meaningful lessons. I mean, I've learned facts.
You had a show about post-traumatic growth, and I think we have that all the time on a very small scale. Every time you waste time, then if you're a smart person, it's not that there's nothing magical about it. It's that you go over and say, what did I do wrong, and how can I avoid that in the future? And so, unfortunately, our educational system now is mostly based on the Pavlov idea that a classroom should be pleasant and children should be rewarded quickly if they get the right answer, and therefore we should never ask them very hard questions. The school hours are 50 minutes, and you can't ask a kid to do something that'll take 20 minutes.
Yeah, and children and parenting today is all about doing everything we can to avoid adversity and to protect them from adversity, which really...
Right. In fact, I despise sports, but from this point of view, the only people who teach dealing with adversity are coaches.
Yeah, that's so very true. Let's see if we can squeeze a call in before we have to take a break. We've got Chris on the line. Chris?
Yes, good afternoon. Very interesting show. We've seen recently the application of robotics to warfare, and there's discussions about applying artificial intelligence to some of these machines like the Predator and so on. What sort of work is being done to help them recognize friend from foe? We have enough problems with humans doing that, and limiting the kind of mayhem that might come out. And I'll just take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Kirsten, you want to tackle that?
This is indeed a very problematic area that there's a lot of discussion in the field at the moment. I find it personally very problematic to give responsibility to machines about, for example, as the caller said, the responsibility making distinctions between friends and foes, because I am personally not aware of any AI system that can to any realistic degree be said that it is modeling the type of behavior in how humans make these decisions. And I think humans are still the very best decision makers when it comes to judging quickly, judging intuitively, judging based on their knowledge, based on the fact that they're human beings, that they have a vast, cultural, intellectual experience. They are very, very, very good at making such decisions. And if you reduce this to a very, very simple, any AI problem-solving mechanisms are much more simpler than what is happening in the human brain, I find this very problematic.
And you used that word again, Kirsten, you used intuition.
yes, intuition is what makes humans humans. And I have not seen anything in AI. I should be careful, probably, because I am an AI researcher. I mean, it is my role at the university also to promote AI. And yes, indeed, I do have a lot of projects in that area. But I am very critical of claims these days, not, you know, hundreds of years in the future, but claims these days that AI systems can faithfully model the way how humans make very complicated, I mean, ethically, socially complicated decisions. Mm. All the systems that I have seen are far, far simpler, and, you know, I find it very problematic to delegate responsibility to such machines.
Yeah, Marvin, you made a comment some 10 years ago in an interview that you said robots can make cars in factories, or but no robot can make your bed or clean your house. and is that still true today?
Yes, because there are only a few people. There might be 20 or 50,000 people working on each particular variety of problem solver, like logic or statistical methods, or some people are trying to simulate evolution, but of course that would take 100 million years.
Right.
And there are only a few people working on common sense reasoning, and so it seems to me that since 1980 AI has not made much progress, and I'm desperately trying to get together a few groups to work on the kind of learning and thinking that children do, and you know, ways to represent experience in 5 or 10 different ways rather than just stimulus response.
Well, despite what both of you are saying, I might respectfully disagree that there has been progress that certainly fascinated me when I did research for this show, and I want to talk about some of the things you have been doing in the field. We'll do that after a short break. We're talking about artificial intelligence, what it is, what it is not, how much progress we're making on it. When we come back from our break, we're gonna learn about some fascinating things that are happening in the field. Our phone number is 888-477-9499. My guests are Kirsten Dautenhahn. She's a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. She's also the associate editor of the International Journal of Social Robotics and the founder of the Aurora Project. That's something we're going to hear about right after our break. Marvin Minsky is one of the pioneers in the field. He started it in 1951. He's co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratories, and he's the author of Society of Mind and the Emotion Machine. Like I said, our number is 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY FM.
Christiana Care supports WHYY and your efforts to stay healthy. Christiana Care offers a free online risk assessment to find out if you are at risk for heart disease, vascular disease, or stroke. Available at christianacare.org/hearttest. By answering a few questions about your health and lifestyle, you can find out if you are at risk for cardiovascular disease or stroke. Online at christianacare.org/hearttest for a free online risk assessment.
Chemotherapy, MRIs, even stem cells are being used to prolong the life of pets. But how do you decide how far to take that therapy? On the next Fresh Air, we kick off our end-of-summer series, Animal Week, with veterinarian Nancy Kaye, author of Speaking for Spot. And scientist Irene Pepperberg talks about the parrot that could tell her how it felt. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about artificial intelligence and robotics. We're going to talk about our relationship to robots and what it means to our future, what it means to us. My guests are Marvin Minsky. He's one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence-based robotics. starting in 1951 with his doctoral dissertation, co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab, and he is the author of Society of Mind and the Emotion Machine. Kirsten Dautenhahn is a professor of artificial intelligence at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. She's associate editor of the International Journal of Social Robotics, and our number is 888-477-9499. Our engineer, Yuna Kwan, asks some people what they associate with artificial intelligence. Let's listen.
Computers, robots, that's not always as reliable. Computers aren't reliable all the time, they break. Cars break, everything breaks, that's mechanical.
I find it absolutely terrifying, actually. I'm really afraid of it because I think we're moving in a direction where machines can do more and more.
I don't know if I necessarily fear it, but it does amaze me at the rate the technology is progressing. It does seem realistic that within a year or two, you know, that advanced of artificial intelligence, like in the movies, could be real every day.
So that's really interesting, those person in the street interviews. They don't sound at all consistent with what we heard before our break, that we have a long, long way to go before we get to, you know, what they fear. What do you think, Marvin? I'll start with you. You've been in the field a very long time. What do you think the fear is about?
Well, it's a very complicated situation because of this backwards evolution. In the 1950s and 60s, people were able to make machines do things that most people thought were very difficult and intellectual, like chess and like mathematics. And in fact, there were problems in mathematics that had been unsolved for hundreds of years, like what's called integration. And in the 1960s, that problem was solved after hundreds of years since Newton raised the question. But what did happen is that all sorts of specialized kinds of robots were built, but none that had the kind of common sense that a young child had. Now that's beginning to open up and people are starting to work on that, but it seems to me that it's almost as though artificial intelligence is actually just starting to be smart and original and resourceful, and we've spent about 50 years of wonderful research on finding ways to make machines do particular things, but we're just beginning to make them more resourceful. So I think the man in the street is right about how rigid and inflexible robots have been in the past. That's going to change, and it's very hard to predict how long it will take. I'd like to interject one remark, which is how incredibly reliable computers are, because in 1 second, a modern computer does several billion things, maybe the order of a trillion in your desktop computer, and they're all correct, in a sense. So potentially, computers could be unthinkably reliable. Now, a machine running at 2 gigahertz is 2,000 million operations per second. So if it runs for 10 minutes, it's inconceivably reliable. However, in 10 minutes, it can do all sorts of crazy things. So it's a funny situation where we have to admire the incredible reliability, and yet on a human scale, we wonder why they're so rigid and inflexible.
Hmm. Kirsten, I want to continue with you about where we are and where we are not in the field. In my research, I looked up the Science Daily webpage, which I consult often. I want to read you and our audience a few headlines, just the headlines. Robotic bugs navigate like cockroaches. Next one, robots to play soccer. Next one, neuroscientists and engineers build a robot that teaches itself to walk up and down hills. The more headlines I read, the more uncomfortable I feel, and I'm not sure why. I mean, these headlines sound like we're making tremendous progress.
I think one of the dangers is to look at all of these many headlines and assume that we are close to integrating all of these into one system, like one system that can do all of that. Now, what you see in these headlines are very fantastic achievements in one particular area, like, for example, robot walking or robot control, robot navigation, robot sensing ability, and so on. These are all very specialized fields, and, of course, a lot of research goes into there, and you do indeed have very, very good results. But what is problematic is to extrapolate and to say, okay, all of these different elements, like in a jigsaw puzzle, all of these different elements are now there. So very, very soon, all of this will make the complete puzzle of this, you know, human-like dancing, singing robot that can, you know, do human-like things in all domains that we can think of. I mean, this is clearly not the case. What you see in these headlines are fantastic achievements in domain-specific areas of AI, of robotics, or humanoid robotics in particular. And it's just necessary to be a little bit cautious in, you know, not assuming that, oh, you know, this is all contributing to this one human-like machine. These are all different expert areas.
Marvin, you referred to common sense of children, that robots don't have that. They have the common sense of a 3-year-old child. What can you tell us about common sense? What is it? And especially in a 3-year-old child, what is common sense? And why do so many adolescents and politicians seem to have lost it? I wonder. but that's another.
Well, I think Kristen's diagnosis is exactly right. Artificial intelligence has made huge progress in a thousand little areas. Like you can now buy a camera that will recognize a face, and you can get a program that will take your cell phone and look at an object and find the price of it on Amazon and so forth. So we have 1,000 wonderful applications of sorts of things that people can do, but we don't have an integrated system that knows a lot of things and knows when to use each of these particular abilities. If you ask Google for Marvin Minsky, you'll get my homepage, and there you can read my book called The Emotion Machine. There's a version of it that's free. And in this book, I suggest that the main problem in artificial intelligence is how do we use all our different resources. And at each moment, there are thousands of things you could do, and we need a higher level system that says, what kind of problem am I facing, and what kind of obstacle is in the way, and what should I do about it? And every child learns thousands of ways, maybe 20,000 different ways to deal with problems. Every day the child learns maybe a few hundred more of these little tricks. And we haven't made much progress on how to put these things together into one system.
Kirsten, in an interview for the BBC, you raised a rhetorical question about the best way for a robot to interrupt us if we're reading a newspaper by gesturing with its arms, blinking with lights, or making a sound. First of all, I don't think I want a robot to interrupt me when I'm reading the newspaper at all. So it raises the relationship, the question about our relationship with robots. And if I am being interrupted, why does it matter how I'm being interrupted?
Yes. I mean, what you quote is a little bit out of context. It was in the domain of service robots. So one of the projects that I'm working on, or several actually, is concerned with how can we develop robots as home companions. And one of the things that we found is that people have very individual preferences in how robots should behave around them, how the robot should approach them, what type of social cues the robot should use. And this this particular phrase that you quoted is about that people have different preferences. What we found, for example, is that depending on a person's personality profile, like, for example, is this person very extroverted, so very social and outgoing, or more introverted, so more shy, that people have these different preferences of how the robot should look like, how it should behave, how it should socially interact and communicate with them. And this was part of the argument that such type of home companions really need to be personalized. So we cannot hope to have this one system that one day comes on the market and everybody will love it and will find it useful and accept it in their home. It is much more likely what you also find in the markets of cars or mobile phones, that you have very, very different types of models, types of systems that you can also personalize and adapt to your preferences. Well, so I mean, coming back to your suggestion, well, I don't want a robot to interrupt me at all. Well, yes, if this is your preference, then this is what the robot should learn, that you really like to read your newspaper and you want to have it peace and quiet, and whether the phone rings or someone is at the door, you do not want to be interrupted. This is something that would be part of the robot's social knowledge, how it is interacting with you and when it should interrupt you and when it shouldn't.
Boy, that raises some terrific questions in my mind, ethical, relational questions about if this robot meets so many of my needs at so many levels, what about other relationships that I'll have less of a longing for, less of a wish? We're going to have to talk about that after our break, and I absolutely want to talk to you, Kirsten, about the Aurora Project and what you're doing to help autistic children with robotics. We are talking about artificial intelligence. Our number is 888-477-9499. Tell us about your thoughts, your dreams, your fears about AI. My guest is Kirsten Doutenhahn, professor of AI at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK. She is the founder of the Aurora Project. Marvin Minsky is one of the pioneers of intelligence-based robotics, co-founder of the Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT, author of Society of Mind. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. That's right here on WHYY-FM.
The National Constitution Center supports WHYY and presents Napoleon, a new exhibit that explores the private life of Napoleon Bonaparte and his impact on the United States and the world. With over 300 rare pieces, including personal belongings, furniture, and fine art, Napoleon, on view at the National Constitution Center now through September 7th. Details at constitutioncenter.org. Presented by Shire Pharmaceuticals, Exhibits Development Group, and Cultural Arts Entertainment Group, distributors and producers.
In her new book, Not All Black Girls Know How to Eat, author Stephanie Covington Armstrong talks about her struggle to overcome bulimia.
I looked at it as similar to being a heroin addict. I mean, I bottomed out.
A personal story about finding a healthy relationship with food. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about artificial intelligence, robotics, our relationship with these robots, and theirs with us. My guests are Marvin Minsky and Kirsten Doutenhahn. Minsky is one of the pioneers, I'd even go so far as to say the pioneer of intelligence-based robotics. He co-founded the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab, and many other things. He's the author of Society of Mind and the Emotion Machine. Kirsten Doutenhahn is a professor of AI at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK and the founder of the Aurora Project, which is just what I want to talk about. I've got about 50 questions I want to ask you guys in the remaining 15 minutes, but I want to start with the Aurora Project. Kirsten, it's fascinating, and I've got a personal interest. I've got a grandson who's on the autism spectrum. So tell us what this project is and how you're using robots to have a therapeutic role for autistic kids?
When I started this project more than 12 years ago, the idea was to say, well, given that robots are becoming more and more interactive, more and more toy-like, can it maybe be used as a toy that can help children with autism, so in the education or therapy of children with autism? Children with autism have a particular, autism is a spectrum disorder, and the children usually have problems in communication, interaction, imagination, and fantasy. Bottom line is, what is very difficult for them to understand and can alienate them is interacting with other people, trying to understand what is interaction, what is communication, what does this person standing in front of me want from me, what does this question mean, how do I interpret this particular phrase. And so social interaction is one of the key difficulties for children. And so we have been working with a range of children over the past, as I said, 12 years, and we have been using different types of robots. So this could be very, machine-like, small, mobile robots that the children can play the little chasing games with. We have also recently used some more human-like robot, not these very sophisticated humanoids that you see in movies, but, very, very simple, abstract-like humanoid shapes where the robots, like our robot Casper, it can express certain gestures, hand movements, waving. It can play little games with the children, like drumming games, imitation games, and so on. And what we do is to expose the children to this toy, as you like, and then to design certain scenarios, like imitation scenarios, like these drumming scenarios. We are investigating how the children can develop certain skills, in particular in the context of other children present or other carers present. This last scenario is the role of social mediation, as we call it, which is not about the role or the purpose of the robot to interact primarily with the children, but it is the child interacting with the robot and another person present. So this is where the robot, if you like, socially mediates between the child with autism and the social world around it. And so we've been working with groups of children in special needs schools, where we bring the robot, where we expose them in long-term studies to the robot, and where we then monitor their behavior. All of this in close collaboration also with the teachers.
One of the things I wondered as I read about this is that these children on the autism spectrum can have relationships with mechanical objects. So couldn't this interfere with their having mutual relationships with regular people?
This is indeed one of the dangers of this type of research. If you only focus on the relationship of the child and the robot, then I would absolutely agree. What might happen is that you only reinforce stereotypical behavior, repetitive behavior, for example, and that you basically only reinforce the child to be withdrawn from the social world. But if you take the alternative view, which is what we like to do, is to say, okay, let us look at the robot as a toy that also involves other people, then suddenly it can become a machine that is mediating, that is trying to help this child to relate to other people, like other children or their carers and their teachers. And this is one of the main areas of research that we are doing.
So the question I have, and maybe I'm asking the wrong person, is why a robot and why not a person to do this?
Often children with autism are very scared of people. They are often withdrawn. Like, for example, if you let me tell the little story of one boy that we've been working with, who,
please,
when he is in school, he would not talk to anyone, not to other children, not to his teachers. When he is being spoken to, like offered a banana, he would take it, but he would not get engaged in any kind of communication or in interaction. Now, what we did is to have this boy playing with our robot Casper for several weeks. This boy was very, very interested, and as you say, this is probably due to the quite mechanical nature of this robot. As I said, this robot has some human-like expressions, but it is clearly still a robot, a mechanical object. And what we saw is that at some point, the boy, while he was, you know, enjoying himself, laughing, having fun with the robot, that he turned towards his carer, signaled to the carer that he wanted her to come close to him, and then they both started playing with each other and with the robot.
What a beauty! What a beauty!
And I mean, obviously these are anecdotes. As I said, we are doing this type of research on the on a case study evaluation basis, so we cannot say that, you know, our robot helps this and this percentage of children. This is something that we would have to show in the future, but it is something that's very difficult to show because of the very heterogeneous nature.
I want to try to promise that we will post the web page of the Aurora Project on our web page. I'm sure we'll be able to do that so our listeners can follow up. Let's go to the phones. We've got Patrick on the line.
Yes, hi.
What can we do for you?
My question was, I'd recently seen the movie AI, the Steven Spielberg movie, where they had a little boy that was capable of love, a robot that was capable of love. Is there anything on the horizon with, you know, maybe a conscience-laden robot as a helper robot, or even one that's capable of love? Or even like the Gigolo character where, you know, he was a male Gigolo and he was a service robot.
Well,
I'll
let you take your question off the air, but my opening question on today's show was, I asked Marvin Minsky, what is artificial intelligence? You're bringing up love, which is a question I wanted to bring up, but, you know, what the hell is that? You know, what is love? Marvin?
Well, there's a joke. If you look at the first chapter of The Emotion Machine, it starts out describing a young man, and the young man is talking and says, "I have just fallen in love with a wonderful person. I can scarcely think about anything else. She's unbelievably perfect, indescribably beautiful, flawless in character, and there's nothing I would not do for her." And that all sounds very positive, but if you look at it another way, you realize it's all negative statements about the person who's talking. When he says indescribable, he's saying, "I can't figure out why I'm attracted." He says, "I can scarcely think of anything else." That means most of my mind has stopped working. And so we can think of love as a situation in which you've turned off your mental critics. Normally, in a situation, you see things that are attractive and you see things you don't like. And to be in love is to... You can think of it as a very simple system in which you've turned off most of your critical abilities.
Well, you know, that's true. And there is some research about that our judgment, our ability to see negatives in the person we love is impaired. But, you know, one of the things that's going on in that description of love is you really moved your awareness from your left brain to your right brain. And, you know... Marvin, it feels so good.
Well, feeling good is a complicated process, and the last chapter of my book talks about what is pleasure for, and one idea is that pleasure is turning off parts of your mind that might interfere with learning. So we think of pleasure as positive usually, but suppose something's happened and part of your mind is trying to figure out why were you successful at this and why did you fail at that. Then what you want is a situation where most of the interfering processes are turned off so that some little parts of your brain, which may be completely unconscious, can work on assigning credit. How come I succeeded? What of the thousands of little ideas I had, which of them were relevant? And so I think one problem is that the words we use in everyday life are huge oversimplifications, and we really have hundreds of processes going on in the mind at once, and most of the words we use for in everyday life are for not asking questions about how we think.
Kirsten, let me ask a different flavor question to you. I practice mindfulness meditation, and one of the goals of mindfulness, one of the things we do, is simply awareness of our minds, just awareness, a kind of metacognition that would allow someone to observe one's experience. Could robots do this? Could they ever do this? It's called consciousness.
I mean, there is a lot of effort, again, in the research community on consciousness, many of them inspired by models, computational models of human consciousness. I'm personally a little bit wary of some of these efforts because consciousness is not something that just happens in our brain. It is something that is connected to how we feel, what we are, what we sense, what we perceive, what we feel, and some of these models are sort of separating the more matter reflection rational side of consciousness from the more emotional experience based dimension. And as far as I'm concerned, I think without making the connection between the two, without basically having consciousness truly embodied in a system, it will be really, really difficult to make the claim that the robot is conscious.
And I would have guessed that's your answer. Unfortunately, we are out of time. I want to thank you both so much for joining us. I think this show was fascinating today, and thanks for taking the time. My guests have been Marvin Minsky. He's one of the pioneers in the field, co-founder of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Project, author of Society of Mind. We're also joined by Kirsten Dautenhahn. She's a professor of AI at the University of Hertfordshire. Next week will be preempted on Labor Day. Join me tomorrow on my web chat for a discussion of compassion fatigue. That's philly.com/ask. Dan. The engineer for today's show has been Fred Snyder. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of radio content. Mike and Scott's the executive producer. Gita Simons is our producer, and she's leaving us after today's show for a couple of months for another kind of production. She's having a baby. Good luck with Gita. We'll miss you. Lisa Walters is our associate producer. Jonathan Glick's our intern. Una Kwan's our volunteer. And I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.
You're enjoying.